Welcome back to the Paula Gordon Show. We're talking with David Halberstam. I'm struck that you say you grew up in a Calvinist era, which guess you would call the
Depression.
Well, this far from Calvinist as you could get.
You didn't have two cars and a family.
Yeah.
Most people we knew didn't own cars, or if they bought cars, they bought secondhand cars. I mean, it was
And you worked like
heck. If you made someone who made $2,000 a year, it was considered a good income.
Yeah.
People don't remember that age. I was born in 1934. Early 1942, my father was a doctor, went back in the service. He'd been a medic in World War I, and he thought that fighting Adolf Hitler, you needed good combat surgeons. He went back. We did what people did in those days. I mean, we had almost marginal income. I mean, whatever you made as an officer's stipend. We gave up our apartment in New York. We took my uncle's house because he had gone in the service. We doubled up. And people, I mean, what your expectations were in the 1940s and even earlier 50s in terms of material things were dramatically lower than they are today, in part because the country was poorer, in part because television is a monstrously powerful amplifier of material wishes had not yet arrived. So the selling machine hadn't come. The need to buy things to keep up with neighbors. It was a much simpler time. I mean, I sometimes look at the what kids can get today at school in their optional purchasing power. My daughter, who's 17, and her contemporaries, their choices compared to mine, and it's staggering. It doesn't mean that we were better or they were better, whatever, but it's very different America.
It's surprising to hear you talk about entertainment economy. Very much the case. What is curious to me about that, in particular the context that you work, entertainment and journalism seem to have sort of merged into one another.
Regrettably, yes.
And I'm curious about two parts of that. One is, how do you characterize this entertainment economy? And then secondly, this, what to us is deplorable connection between journalism and entertainment. How are we going to deal with that?
Well, I think that if you look at the American economy, our great sales overseas are not automobiles or machine tools. They are the products of our popular culture.
Mm-hmm.
They're singers, they're television shows, they're Michael Jordan selling Nike sneakers. They're movies. In fact, one of the reasons we have so many really bad big ticket movies is because
somebody will buy
them. Screenplays is that they sell wonderfully well all over the world, and you don't really need a screenplay if you've got some kind of major, what they call a whammy, which is a tornado, murder, or whatever. The less screenplay, the less human heartbeat, almost the better, because this other stuff tracks well across national borders as a play like Death of a Salesman would not. So that's the fact, and you look at who the big winners are. I mean, it isn't General Motors and Ford. It's Rupert Murdoch. It's Michael Eisner struggling, buying up baseball teams, buying up magazines, trying to get what they believe is economic synergy. So that's the new kind of power, and it's driven by the explosion in technology. We don't even know what the next step is. We have newspapers. We don't know in 5 or 10 years what the delivery system will be. So the second part of that is, the blending of journalism and entertainment, which has a kind of melancholy, I think, for a person of my values, outcome in the sense that when I was a young man and through most of my career, great editors, whether it was someone like Ben Bradley at the Washington Post or Nick Williams at the LA Times, balanced, Bill Kovich in his cameo appearance in this city, balanced what people wanted to know with what they needed to know. That kind of obligation isn't there anymore. It's all really driven by ratings. We have journalists, alleged journalists, who make $7 and $8 million a year now. And I don't think many of them are in the same business that I was in. I mean, I think that they will do almost anything. You know, if their executive producer comes in and says, and it's mostly in the magazine shows. I'm not talking about the anchorman, but if they come to work and the executive producer who's responding to ratings says, do such and such a show, which is about a celebrity entertainer or a new provocative murder case, they'll do that. I mean, the idea that there's any... I mean, the great journalists of my era, like Harrison Salisbury and Homer Biggert, were driven by issues that were compelling to the public agenda, whether it was issues overseas or race here in America, and they went out and covered those stories. They didn't make them sexy. It didn't make them popular. I don't think either of them
made
a salary as a reporter of over $50,000 a year when they were reporting. But, I mean, the reward was in the doing. I don't think that's necessarily true. Now, I think these people may think the reward is in the doing, but it isn't, because the doing is, in fact, done by producers.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when one
so
of these
the
famous people
front
from
people.
60 Minutes parachutes in on a famous 60 Minute story, he or she doesn't do a lot of reporting. It's virtually scripted. And 60 Minutes is the best of the magazine shows.
Right.
There's been a producer there for 2 weeks who's done all the heavy reporting. So it's not about the doing.
Your colleague Ken Auletta talks about the special role that journalists occupy in a democracy and how important it is to be able to have substantive information which makes it possible for the public to make good decisions.
All the more important in a democracy.
And what you're describing to me sounds as if there's beginning to be a separation between what we characterize as news anyway, maybe perhaps not journalism, and that function.
I think so. I think this is a sort of... I think the word melancholy comes to mind again. I don't think it's a happy time. I think the networks have been egregious in violating a certain kind of trust. I think we got these great freedoms not so that Michael Eisner could make $200 million a year, or Diane Sawyer could make $7 or $8 million a year, or Sam Donaldson could make a comparable amount and get a lecture fee of $35,000 a pop, particularly when he has so little to say.
You don't think Tom Jefferson had that in mind, huh?
What?
You
don't think think they had that in mind. No, I think we got this because we were the keeper of a public interest, and in our imperfect, often volatile way, we would ventilate the issues that were before those of our fellow citizens, and in some mysterious chemical or alchemical process in this broth, there would be a blend of what was real, and people could finally make good decisions and would have information alternative to that which the federal local government was giving them. And I mean, I say that as a witness to that process in both Vietnam and in the civil rights movement, that particular role, I think, is very important. I think we've strayed very far from that. I think the signature people now in television, particularly, not the anchormen, but the signature people in the magazines, are about giving people what allegedly they want, which, by the way, they don't want. I mean, I think that you can see it now in the Monica Lewinsky case, is that that not only is Mr. Starr in bad odor and Ms. Tripp in bad odor and Mr. Ginsburg. I mean, here we have, my God, William Ginsburg. I mean, you know, what's his name? Oh, Andy Warhol said we'd all have 15 minutes, and there's William Ginsburg, who has been at 14 minutes, 59 seconds, and counting for a very long time. And, listen, I know very well that when you mix sex with a political process in Washington, it's a hot story. But the disproportion in coverage of this and the kind of titillation and enthusiasm on so many people in Washington, when there are other stories that are really terribly important about what the future of this country is, it's disproportionate. It's not good.
We're going to come back and talk about some of those other stories as well with David Halberstam. Bill Russell and I are at the Commerce Club with David Halberstam, and we hope you'll stay tuned.